Welcome to the 70th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
Welcome to the podcast that would love to invite New Zealand to take part in the Ashes.
And what a series it's been, this England-New Zealand Test series. It's not often that the sort of precursor to the main series actually is anything other than a damp squib. So I suppose we sort of take our hats off to the New Zealanders. That sounds very condescending because, you know, really it's been down to them rather than down to England. But you got to see some of it, didn't you?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to be at Lord's for the fourth day of the first test. And I'll admit that prior to this game, I hadn't really drunk the Ben Stokes Kool-Aid. I mean, I understood that why people got excited about him. He was a very aggressive player.
Can I just quickly ask, is Kool-Aid a thing that Ben Stokes does?
Well, what is
Kool-Aid? It's one of these isotonic drink things.
So Kool-Aid, as you should know, as a literate man such as yourself, is, you know, if you're fanatical about something, you know, you drink the Kool-Aid of that thing. And I've actually been wanting
heard that expression.
Have you never
before?
Heard this expression?
Never.
It's funny
because
since I first heard this expression, I've been determined to use it, and I've been trying to determine to use it almost as often.
Isn't Kool-Aid what you put in the radiator of your car though?
I think it could
maybe that's cooling aid. Anyway, look, we're getting hung up. The fact is that you hadn't really seen eye to eye with those who praise Ben Stokes.
I think he had a quickly growing fan club, which I wasn't yet to be a member of. And actually, what I saw early on in his innings kind of confirmed my reservations. Super aggressive, but alarmingly sketchy. I mean, edges galore. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, he just became unstoppable. Now, in this world of T20 cricket, 100 off 85 balls doesn't actually seem all that much, but it's the quickest test 100 ever at Lord's. And what made it seem utterly improbable was all morning we'd seen Cook and Root basically just struggling to survive against the swinging ball. And suddenly Stokes came out. And I read something recently about Roger Federer, and it was a journalist called William Skidelsky writing about Roger Federer. And he talked, I guess, a little bit pretentiously about how it seems as if Federer bends the universe to fit what he wants. It felt a little bit like this with Ben Stokes. You know, New Zealand could bowl the ball wherever they wanted. It was going, it would go.
The interesting thing about this this innings, one of the interesting things about this innings for me was the fact that it wasn't against a kind of a B team, because often a player comes and they play an innings like this and you go, yeah, but what's going to happen when they face actually a decent bowling attack? You know, what's going to happen when they get to the Ashes? But actually, this one felt like a genuinely good innings against a genuinely good bowling attack as well.
Well, and I think I've never seen an innings with quite such a psychological effect, because we've documented a lot in this podcast, I guess, the difficulty between the relations of the England cricket supporting public and the ECB, and the crowd just came to life during this. They needed something like this. They needed an innings like this just to remind themselves that this England team was worth being excited about. And it was amazing seeing the life drain out of the New Zealand side, because you're right, it's a world-class attack. I mean, Tim Southey with the new ball was sent for three sixes in an over, you know, and you could see these New Zealanders who'd actually, for most part, been on top of England for most of this test match. The belief drained away, and it was a really, really staggering innings.
Now, talking about psychological effects, I wonder what the psychological effects on you as a batsman would be if you suddenly turned around and you saw that the wicketkeeper had taken off their pads and their gloves and were standing at fly slip and there was no wicketkeeper on the pitch at all. Because this obviously is something that happened last week, I think, maybe even this week. We're recording on Saturday evening, in a 2020 game against Northants, when Worcestershire decided in the 16th over that what they were going to do was take the keeper Ben Cox, ask him to take his pads and his gloves off and put him in at fly slip. And a long debate kind of ensued between the umpires about whether this was something that was legal within the laws of the game. They decided that it was, and actually Worcestershire, having done this rather bold and innovative move, went on to successfully defend the 211 that they'd scored, and they went on to win by 16 runs.
So in your view, do you think this is something that would only work very, very specifically to a type of spinner? Or I'm trying to see the rationale where, having never attempted this before, you would suddenly see the knee. I guess, do they feel that the ball is turning so much that the keeper's just going to be taken out of the game, or...?
No, I think the idea was that if you cramp the batsman and you bowl everything on the stump, so the batsmen have to play everything and you have the spinners who can bowl that kind of line, then actually what's the point in having a having a keeper effectively if you want to basically defend and attack at the same time, which I suppose was where the fly slip comes in. I haven't actually seen any footage of this having happened, and it'd be interesting if anyone has seen it, if they tweet at us and tell us how it worked out. But I suppose it's just that thing of sometimes with 2020, as a captain, you scratch your head and you think, if only I had one more fielder, everything would look completely different. And actually, this is one way of giving yourself one more fielder. And the thing that struck me about it was that actually often the innovations in 2020 are around, you know, giving batsmen bigger biceps and bigger bats. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's quite nice for a bowling captain to come up with an innovation like this specifically for the 2020 game.
Well, what's really exciting about it is that some of these interesting fielding options then transition their way into other forms of the game. So, for example, Brendan McCullum, we saw some really interesting stuff from him throughout the test series, particularly just in certain cases just entirely ignoring the offside. So we had the onside, so almost entirely offside fielders. So yeah, I agree that it's very exciting to see some of these innovations.
So that's what's been happening in England. You're going to take us over to the other side of the world now, I believe.
Yeah, well, I think for long-term listeners of this podcast, it's well aware that I'm a big Shiv Chanderpool fan. Love his
By which you mean that since episode one, you've been banging on about how the West Indies are going to turn around at some point.
With Shiv Chanderpool at the fore. But sadly, he's no longer at the fore. You know, I love his unflappability. I love how, through again and again, endless West Indies collapses, he's left standing amidst the rubble, just keeping on going. But the West Indies have dropped him for this series against Australia. And I think it was always going to be sad, I think, to see him go. It's sad, I think, to see any great player go. I think I don't want to get into too much of a debate over the issue of selection, because you can argue it both ways. I think I reckon he'd earned the chance to say farewell to Windies fans. I know that's controversial. I know there's sometimes a sense, well, look, just pick your best 11, whatever it is. But I also think for someone of his record, surely you want to go into a series against Australia with him there, with his experience, with his fantastic record against the Australians, actually. Mm. But I think what's been really interesting is a text conversation between Chanderpool and coach Phil Simmons has now been made public, and it is really interesting to understand the dynamic. And Simmons kind of politely suggests to Chanderpool that he announces his retirement, because in his words, Chanderpool retiring would be more dignified than Chanderpool being left out by the selectors. And you sort of understand what Phil Simmons is doing here. He is worried, I guess, about Chanderpool's reputation. He wants Chanderpool to be seen to be doing it on his own terms. But there's also something a bit unpleasant about a player who has given more to West Indies cricket than almost anyone being sort of hustled in that way. And I love...
Well, and particularly by text message as well. It's an extraordinary way to do things. But I suppose the benefit is that we do then get to see this correspondence, because it wasn't verbal. And actually, Chanderpool, what's Chanderpool's reply to
Chanderpool's
that?
Chanderpool's rather wonderful sign-off in capital letters, "I am not retiring," and then signs off with "thanks." So defiant but polite till the end. And yeah, sadly, I think it is the end of him, but it does bring around this thing. It is very, very hard for great players to go gracefully, and we've seen it with Tendulkar, and I think it is probably a problem without resolution. Now, you've been saddened by a retirement that certainly has come well before its time.
Absolutely. So I was, I'd been kind of vaguely aware of the fact that Craig Kiesewetter had an eye injury at some point in the past, a little while ago, when a ball snuck between his grill and his helmet and hit him in the eye socket. But it was announced this week that he is going to retire from all forms of cricket because of this eye injury, both because of the injury itself, the physical injury, but also because of the amount that it's affected his confidence, actually, in the way that he sort of plays the game. And, you know, Craig Kiesewetter, for me, was never someone who was going to set the world alight. Having said that, he was man of the match when England won the T20 World Cup, so I suppose that's about as close to, well, it's closer to setting the world alight than I'm ever going to get. But there is something very, very sad about a cricketer in their prime, a good cricketer, a very good county cricketer, a very good cricketer for England, being cut short by this kind of freak accident.
And I think, I guess we're all after what happened to Philip Hughes last year, we're all so much more aware now, I think, or so much more reminded of the fact that this does remain, for all the protective equipment that's come into it, it can still be a very, very dangerous sport. And I think your point about the confidence is a really interesting one, because, you know, there's been this ongoing discussion over Stuart Broad, and ever since he took that very substantial blow in the face in the Test series against India, his batting has really struggled. And I think it's something that we forget, that it is asking a lot of a player to go through a trauma like that and then bounce back as if nothing's happened. And in this case, sadly, it's proven too much to ask.
From the archives. Now, it's one of the iconic sounds of the summer, and I'm not talking about leather on willow, I'm talking about wood on wood. In this From the Archives, Andy's going to talk to us about the art of knocking in a cricket bat.
So the idea for this feature came to me as I entered the fourth hour of knocking in my new cricket bat, and I thought, what on earth am I doing? Now, I haven't actually got a new cricket bat for a very, very long time. My previous chase has served me very, very well, so I haven't been confronted with this dilemma for a while. And I was just sitting there sort of hitting the bat with a mallet, and I thought, cricket is obviously a game of many strange rituals, but there are few stranger than purchasing a beautifully crafted bat and then spending several hours hitting it with a mallet before you can use it.
So where were you doing it? Where were you knocking your bat in? Because I remember this always being a bone of contention, particularly at school, when I was at a boarding school, and we used to sit up late at night knocking our bats in and were told off. And we also weren't allowed to do it on the boundary of the cricket pitch, because apparently that would disturb the play. Where did you knock in your cricket?
Well, it is an extremely annoying activity. So I actually did the most of it. I did while watching. This makes me sound an unbelievably sad human being, but I'm halfway through the story, so I'm going to have to
go on.
It. Yep. I was watching the Question Time election debates on iPlayer.
Well, that's not incredibly
sad. And sitting there watching it on exceptionally loud volume, so that I could also, you know, hit the cricket bat extremely hard. But I'm also extremely lucky to have had both tolerant housemates and tolerant family who are willing to listen to that.
Why is it that we have to knock in a cricket bat? I've never actually known.
Yeah,
really.
So I started to look a bit further. I guess we all know that we all vaguely know that it's because if we don't, they might crack and they might break. But similar to you, I was not really aware of the intricacies behind it. The odd thing about cricket bats is that they're made out of willow, which is obviously an exceptionally soft wood. I mean, if you've come into contact with sort of willow as a wood in its unprocessed form, it's an exceptionally soft wood, and in some ways seems deeply counterintuitive to make a bat that's going to have to withstand real impact out of it. Now, so what you do is you press the willow, which gives it the springiness that we love in a cricket bat. What's interesting is that actually, cricket bats are obviously involved in lots and lots of different ways, but the pressing machines have barely evolved. If you look at them, they are these kind of massive hulking metal contraptions, you know, recognizable from you know, Victorian times. That they really haven't moved. So they do the bulk of the pressing. Now, you could use the pressing machine to press the bat very, very strongly, and that would create a very hard bat, but one with no spring to it. So what you do is you press it to a certain degree, and then that final hardening has to be done by hand. So that final sort of hitting with a mallet or hitting it with a ball in a sock has to be done by hand. One thing that is quite interesting is that actually...
So you're actually hardening the bat rather than softening it when you hit it with a... Because I was under the impression that somehow you're softening the wood when you're hitting it with
no,
a bit like you'd soften a steak when you hit it. But you're hardening
you're
and compressing
actually
the wood more when you're knocking it in.
It's exactly that. You're compressing that very, very top layer. That very, very top layer of the bat to make that hard. It's also why, interestingly, I found out during getting some advice for knocking in my bat, why it's absolutely critical to knock in the edges. Because the edges of the bat unknocked in are apparently really quite easy to almost just chip off. And you're compressing those edges.
Yeah.
And you can actually see yourself visibly flattening those edges. Now, we're going to go the closest... Well, I don't think this is science, but we're going to go the closest to using a scientific term that we probably ever have in this podcast. I'm going to tell you a little bit about delamination, Toby.
Go on, do it. It's like being 17 in the physics class again,
Now
but that's okay.
we've compressed the willow. We've compressed it with the pressing machine, and then we've hardened it with either the mallet or, the famous socket, ball in sock. And the fibers of the willow, however, after being pressed, they then start to separate again. So, you've pushed them together, but they slowly start to separate again. And as I said, I was completely unaware of this process. Now, what I find genuinely quite fascinating is the point at which the bat is at its best is just when that process begins. So when you've
And
got
this process, sorry, is called delamination. That's the process of
delamination.
when the
It is when these
of when
willows
the
come
of when the
apart.
willow fibers start to come apart.
And
Yeah, okay.
apparently that lovely feeling that you get, hopefully with a new well knocked in bat, is the start of that process. So when the bat start just feels nice and springy. So yes, and I think I said having looked into this, it has made me think it'd be lovely at some point on the podcast to get a cricket bat manufacturer on, and we can have a chat about it. So maybe if you're listening and
Yeah.
you're a cricket bat manufacturer, get in touch. We'd love to talk to you. But having given you all the science, it's also quite clear that basically this is more an art than a science, because if you read all the guides on the internet, as I rather tediously have, to the mystery of to when you when do you know that you've finished knocking in a bat? And they all come back to the sound, and it's also the mystery of the right ping. So you want to get to a point where you hit your bat and you get this lovely kind of high-pitched ping. And obviously that there's nothing very scientific to that, but I would argue that most cricketers who've played the game for any real period of time will know exactly what that means. They'll know exactly what that right sound is of hitting the middle of the bat and getting that right noise.
And actually, it's part of the real satisfaction of knocking in a bat is knowing that you're preparing something and getting it to the stage where, you've bought a bat off the shelf and you kind of make it your own by knocking it in, and then you go into the middle with this thing that you've sort of created yourself as well as just buying almost.
So I think this is exactly it, because I was faced with this dilemma that I think most players are when they buy a new bat, which is actually there are shops you can take it into and you can pay 15, 20 quid and get it knocked in. And to be honest, that's kind of what I thought I would do. I thought, God, I'm not going to spend hours sitting around with this thing. But then once I started, I actually found myself oddly quite enjoying it. And it is exactly that. I think there are very few other sports where you actually play a role in crafting the instrument that you go out and play with. No one does this with their golf clubs. You don't. Well, I guess very few players are in a position to make their own golf clubs. And I think there's something special about it, because ultimately, as a cricketer, you're going to spend many, many hours out in the middle, with this chunk of wood. And I guess there's something quite fun, about the idea that you've actually been involved in the preparation of it. To the review, and this episode we've been watching the BBC4 documentary The Captain and the Bookmaker, which tells the story of the rise and fall of Hansi Kronje. Now, this is a well-known story within cricket, so what did the film teach you that you didn't already know?
Well, one of the things I thought was quite interesting about the documentary is the way that it looks quite holistically at Cronje's life. It goes all the way through from when he was a schoolboy to his tragic death in a plane accident. One of the most interesting things for me is just the emphasis on how much of a kind of model person he was, both as a schoolboy, as the captain of the school cricket team, through to the kind of uniting figure, particularly post-apartheid as well, within South African society, which in turn creates even more of a mystery around why someone who seemed to have all of the moral qualities that you could look for in a leader would become someone who was in league with the bookmakers,
But
if you
this is
like.
what's fascinating, because some of the skills that made him such a great leader, a great head boy at school, and such a great captain were also to make him so successful at doing wrong. I mean, there's a couple of wonderful lines in the film: a great motivator, but also a great manipulator. And they also said that when within the South Africa camp, because he was such a great leader, what he said became the law. And it's this very interesting distinction that the skills that are put to the use of making you a great captain also put you in a position of almost a dictatorship, really. It
And
wasn't
that's.
just the control over the players. The documentary makes the case that he had total control over the coach, over Bob Woolner.
And that's one of the very sad things, actually, that comes out of the documentary is the way that he treats Henry Williams and Herschel Gibbs, who are the two coloured players who, and there are all of these interwoven parts going on here. Two coloured players who really were beacons of hope in post-apartheid South Africa. And so yet, Cronje targets them so strongly to be, you know, to involve them in his web of deceit. So at the same time, he's the person who's seen as being the great captain, drawing in all of these races into his cricket team. And also, at exactly the same time, he's actually completely abusing that for his own ends.
So I completely agree, because I think there is an aspect of the film that sort of makes the tragic flaw argument, that isn't this sad that this great man was brought down by his greed, basically. I mean, there's the bookmaker Marlon Arenstam quotes a conversation where Cronje just said to him, "How else can I make more money?" But you think, oh, there's almost something forgivable about that—a great man brought down by one flaw. But what makes it very hard for me to feel any sort of forgiveness towards Cronje is that ruthlessness with which he targeted Henry Williams and Herschel Gibbs, the two players most vulnerable, and as you I think put well, were beacons of hope and had that responsibility. I think I've got to come back to Marlon Arenstam, the bookmaker, because for me he is the most intriguing character in the film. He's an extraordinary, you know, he was responsible for the leather jacket test, that third test of the England-South Africa series, where Cronje pulled off that slightly bizarre, that there was that double declaration deal that led to that final day and led to a result. And he's it's astonishingly brazen. He's completely at ease with what he did.
Well, I mean, to the extent that actually when I was watching it, I was suddenly thinking to myself, was it actually somehow legal what he was doing? Because there he sits talking on camera, and not only is he completely sort of upfront about saying all of the dealings that in a sense the interviews with Arenstam make the documentary worth watching in and of itself, I think, but not only is there the kind of legal thing, but as you say, he seems entirely unrepentant about what this is going to do, and he, you know, about the implications of bookmaking on the game more generally.
Well, he I mean, I think he doesn't see criminality in what he did. So he's and I did a bit more research on him, and he's very much involved within the South African horse racing scene, and he says, like anyone owning a racehorse, you seek an edge, you seek information. That was all he felt he was doing. And in terms of the brazenness of it, he talks about handing money to Cronje in an envelope over breakfast. He had breakfast with his son and with Cronje, and they were sitting there, and so there was nothing covert about any of this. I think in terms of the film's defining image, and I think I've already said I find it a little bit difficult to summon much sympathy for Cronje, but he stands in front of the King inquiry, and he gives not quite the full story, but most of the story, and at the end he breaks down in tears, and he has to be helped away by his brother and another friend, and I did find that an extraordinarily powerful image, actually, and I hadn't seen that before. This idea of this man who had the sporting world at his feet, a national figure of unity, and seeing him just so broken that he couldn't stand unassisted is an image that I won't forget.
So, the last word. Now, this is a new segment on the podcast. We started it last episode, and it's a chance for us to look forward to what's going to be happening over the next few weeks. Now, Andy, you, and I'm very jealous of you, have been able to get to Lord's to see some of the England-New Zealand test. Will you be going and seeing any of the one-dayers in 2020s?
I won't be, and I wish I had another test to go and see. I think it was so unfortunate that to have it beautifully poised at one all after two tests, we don't have a deciding third test. I mean, it was something we've talked about on this podcast before. Two test series just feel really odd, and they feel really half-baked. I mean, it can sort of make sense, I guess, when there's a mismatch and you just think, right, we've done enough of this. But we've talked before, these ODI series out of context just feel so pointless. I can't remember ever who really won. I think the one thing that sort of redeems this in my eyes is it is quite an exciting looking England squad. We've got a really interesting bunch of young talents here,
and also it's a good English squad. It's a good New Zealand squad as well, and particularly after the World Cup, where we saw what New Zealand are capable of in terms of one-dayers, there is the opportunity actually for this. I agree, it would have been nice to have another test, but there is the opportunity for this. However many it is, you know, 25 ODIs and 37 T20s that are happening over the next 3 weeks, there's the opportunity for them to sort of generate their own interest as a series as well, I think.
Well, what would be great is if England could somehow, by osmosis, take on some of the approach approach that New Zealand take to their ODI cricket. And I think, you know, maybe that's the useful thing of a five ODI series, that being up front and close to that approach will be very interesting. Because, you know, New Zealand's dismantling of England in the World Cup, I think, was, well, it was the death knell for the way England have been playing ODI cricket for too long. I mean, you know, England were bowled out pitifully for just over 100. New Zealand ran up the runs in 15 overs. England need to play the New Zealand way, and maybe five ODIs against them will be a good, well, a good way of starting to move towards that.
Now, the other thing is that I return to England for the first time in a year in about 3 weeks' time. Roll out the red carpet and all that, and I'm very much thinking that
get
what
the
we should do
Carlsbergs
is,
in.
Is we should get some cheap Carlsbergs and we should go down to Arundel, sit under the castle and watch a county game down there. And I think that would definitely be something to look forward to in the next couple of weeks.
I cannot think of a better plan than that.